Hi, I'm Brian DeShazer, director of the Pacifica Radio Archives, the oldest and largest collection of public radio programming in the United States. And welcome to From the Vault. In this edition of From the Vault, we present our earliest known recording of Japanese Americans and their families living in California talking about life in America. The year was 1959, and KPFA in Berkeley, California opened its doors and its microphones to welcome the Japanese Americans to tell their stories.
I stayed in the first grade about two or three days. Well, at the end of about 1 month, they put me up to, I think it was fifth grade. When I was about 18, my father went back to Japan. From there on, I couldn't go to school, so I had to quit school and work myself.
The Japanese began to immigrate to America by large numbers in the late 1880s through the early 20th century. By 1942, there were 127,000 Japanese Americans living in the continental United States, and of those, 112,000 were living on the West Coast. This is the classic example of the American dream, an immigrant group working hard, raising their families, and making an effort to assimilate and make contributions to their new home country. That all changed following the Imperial Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor, which brought the United States into World War II full throttle. Soon after that event, President Franklin Delano Roosevelt signed Executive Order 9066 on February 19, 1942, authorizing the internment of all the 112,000 Japanese living on the West Coast. This extraordinary act of wartime hysteria and racism would only be officially acknowledged when President Ronald Reagan signed the Civil Liberties Act of 1988, which provided $20,000 to surviving detainees and their heirs, totaling $1.6 billion. But now we turn to our extraordinary recording of Japanese Americans and their families from 1959, talking about family life before the war and how the internment process changed their lives forever. This program was produced by Marshall Windmiller from Pacifica Station KPFA 94.1 in Berkeley, California. You will hear from ordinary citizens, teachers, students, lawyers, architects, and farmers. But you'll also hear from Hito Akato, one of the founders and past presidents of the oldest and largest Asian civil rights group. It was called Japanese America Citizens League, and it was founded in 1929. We're proud to present Marshall Windmiller's program, Japanese in California, from 1959.
Pacifica Foundation presents The Japanese in California, one of a series of programs dealing with racial minorities, produced by KPFA Berkeley, under a grant from the Columbia Foundation.
There are only about 160,000 Japanese in the United States, and most of them live on the West Coast. They refer to themselves as the Issei, Nisei, and Sansei. That is the first, second, and third generations. The Issei began coming to America in the 1890s, but their numbers were greatly limited by legislation designed to keep out Orientals. Only their children, born in this country, are citizens. The program you are about to hear makes no attempt to exhaust the subject or to recite all the facts of history. It is rather a verbal montage of the characteristics of a group and an attempt to convey something of the feeling of what it is like to be a Japanese in California.
I dreamed about America, heard quite a bit from my father. And I sure wanted to come over here and see what kind of a country it is, you know.
Led by that dream, this Issei came, as we or our ancestors all came to America, to face the day-to-day facts of existence on foreign soil. Each of the many voices you will hear speaks not only for an individual, but for countless others like him, sharers of the dream, participants in the events. Who can say how much the dream helped to create the reality?
Well, when I first came, there wasn't very many Japanese boys to go to school. And most of the people were old men, no women folks, you know. And Well, everywhere you go, you didn't see, you just see a man, a Japanese. No families or no of their own house to live in. So the first thing when I came over here, I had to stay with friends. A couple of years after I came over here, women started to come in. I stayed in the first grade about 2 or 3 days. So the second grade, third grade. Well, at the end of about 1 month, they put me up to, I think it was fifth grade. Well, I stayed in the American family. I stayed in as a schoolboy, and of course I studied pretty hard there. And I was, of course, I was old, too old to be with the first, second, or third grade, you see. I think that was the reason that they put me up in upper grade. My father was working, and only way I had to work and help him too. So I had to go in as a houseboy. When I was about 18, my father went back to Japan. And from there on, I couldn't go to school, so I had to quit school and work myself.
Later in Stockton, there was a hub in the downtown area, which would be comparable to the what they call Japanese town in San Francisco. And my father was, he built the, I think he was the first Japanese, immigrant, to build his own home in Stockton. And in so doing, we moved, more or less to the outskirts of town. It was still what you would consider the wrong side of the tracks, but it was an area in which he was able to, obtain a lot and build a home. The neighborhood was, as I recall now, was predominantly an Italian neighborhood, and they didn't seem to mind. Then many Japanese families moved into the area. And I grew up in a neighborhood that was, within a 4 or 5 block radius, I imagine there must have been 20 Japanese families. And the rest of the families were probably of Italian origin.
You know, it's just something that you know that you're different and that you're somehow not part of the community. And I guess you feel it more in us, you know, in a rural community. My brothers, however, can distinctly remember being stoned and this kind of thing when they were growing up. But it was less open. You led two different lives, I recall. You went to school with them and you engaged in all kinds of activity with them in the school. But once you were out of school, then the line was clearly drawn. You never saw each other socially. It was just very, very clear. And you left it at school. All this idea of democracy is just forgotten the minute you leave the school.
Well, I think in those days I didn't mind it too much. Although the minorities, Negroes, Mexicans, Chinese, and Japanese were in a somewhat a segregated part of town. The schools weren't segregated, however, and I hadn't given great thought to the human relations in those days, but thinking back on it, I did realize that although I had Caucasian friends, we never invited them to our home, nor was I invited to theirs.
I lived on a farm, truck farm, dirt farm, and I grew up during the Depression. I was a kid. during the Depression, a young kid. And the well, my friends, it was sort of an intermixed community, and there was Mexicans, and we didn't play with too much. It was a rural community, and neighborhoods were far. Our closest neighbor was another Japanese family about, oh, maybe 3/4 of a mile away. And whenever we did play with anyone, we played with them, which was maybe once a month. There was Japanese families, say, within a radius of 3-4 miles, who sort of had a community of their own. And they were, quite a few of them, let's say about half the old men, were quite nationalistic. And they tried to carry on Japanese traditions and ceremonies and so on. They had a Japanese school.
This class is we call Buddhist Japanese class. We start with a short ceremony with the gassho. Gassho is this salutation to the Buddha, and also end with the gassho. And the main purpose of this class is to give them some religious knowledge through language acquaintance, because many terminologies in Buddhism are mostly untranslatable, hard to translate. We can't find a very adequate or suitable word in English. So sometimes using original Japanese or original Sanskrit Chinese word are more convenient. So in that point, we need, we feel the necessity of giving the small children the knowledge of Japanese. So our purpose is to give the religious education as well as language knowledge. So we call this Buddhist Japanese class.
I notice in our church where the minister speaks Japanese, a lot of the sanseis can't understand it. So the trend is now to obtain English-speaking ministers for these Buddhist churches in order that the sanseis will be able to understand.
I do feel that language is something that we should maintain in some form or another, at least in terms of talking, maybe not so much reading, but at least talking, which I'm not very good at, and I could get by, but I mean, I certainly could learn a lot more than I already know. With the older generation, you can get by speaking half Japanese and half English.
I have many friends who speak Japanese only. I have a friend who is was educated in Japan. I have a friend who came from Japan after the war. And I have a friend who is so-called war brides. There are many people who speak Japanese rather than English. But my association is, I say, about 50-50. No, but about 70 English-speaking and 30 Japanese-speaking.
all of my children speak English, because it's hard for me to teach right now. If I talk to Japanese to them, it's all right, but I try to speak English, and if I speak Japanese between them, this, I don't think too good, so I try to speak in English now. And then since they speak English outside anyway, but I like them to learn Japanese. So my oldest boy is going to be 6, so I once in a while try to teach them, him. He's interesting too, and he copies what I say.
I'm not living with my parents now. It's just my wife and my child. And my wife doesn't speak too much, and of course, it's a chore trying to get my little girl to speak. But I've maintained it through my parents and through the years that I attended a Japanese school in the city. And the Issei people that I'm fortunate enough to get in contact with, through them I seem to maintain my knowledge of the language.
I don't know if this is bad or good. The Japanese is number one people who forget about the Japanese language. So, you see, especially compared with the Chinese or other Spanish-speaking people, most other people, even second or third generation, speak very fluent mother language. But this Japanese generation, already second generation, their knowledge of Japanese are very poor, so very fast to forget. That means in one point very bad, but in another point their assimilation is very good, I think.
In 1941, there were 112,000 Japanese on the Pacific coast. Two-thirds of them were American citizens. By the end of 1942, they had all been forced to leave their jobs, give up their homes and businesses, and be interned behind barbed wire. They had not been charged with any crime. They had merely had Japanese ancestors. And on December 7th, 1941, the Imperial Japanese Navy had attacked Pearl Harbor, and the United States had gone to war with Japan.
Playing golf that morning, and when I came home noontime, I heard about it. I didn't dream that we would be evacuated. I thought that as American citizens that we would be protected in this way. We thought maybe the alien Japanese would be evacuated, but not the citizens. And we felt it was quite discriminatory because the Italians and the Germans were enemies too, and the East Coast was just as vulnerable. There were submarines lurking in that area, but they never moved any of them because they were strongly settled in that area. They had influence and influential people backing them. And then we were here for some time, but then we were evacuated to Tanforan, the stables of Tanforan there. Stayed there for some time, and we shipped to Topaz, Utah, where I stayed for a while, but I was one of the first to leave and go to Chicago, where we were more or less in free territory, live our own lives.
Well, I didn't like it because why Japanese alone? How about the German and Italian? They are was in the same situation. But because we are, you know, so-called Orientals, and flat nose and funny eyes, we were kicked out of the state.
Not because Japan was close to the, you know, Pacific coast, I don't believe. The German or Italian or any other group could have done the same damage if they wanted to for the national security, but they weren't kicked out. And I went to one of those, you know, assembly centers. I didn't like it, of course. The first chance I had was to go to Idaho to work in a farm. So I grabbed that chance and I went to Idaho, work in a farm. Most during the summertime and autumn, and then the wintertime, they didn't have too much work. So I went into one of those camp. From there, I volunteered for the army, at the army language school, to become an interpreter or some language thing. Then I went overseas, stationed in Guam. And for a little while, I was working on one of those station, radio station, listening to the, Japanese radios, and then the Japanese army and the navy radios and those things. And there's a chance came and I was able to volunteer for the flight over or around the Japanese islands. I volunteered for that. I guess I flew close to 100 hours flight time. And then one day I got wounded in Iwo Jima. So after that, I was in the hospital, and then they sent me back to the hospital over here in the state. I got discharged. And as soon after I got discharged, I got the job I got now.
A terrible thing. That's the thing that I felt about it. And I was working my way through school, and I was staying at the dean's place, and we had an idea that we were going to be moved, and the dean would not believe me when I would say we were leaving, that I thought we would have to be moved or something. And I remember the time that, it was toward the end of the semester, and the army posted these things on the thing, and that was the first time I found out about it. And I remember running into the dean's office and saying, I have to make arrangements to leave. And the dean would not believe it until we dragged him out and showed it to him, and then he realized this was it. And then there was no time really to think about it because we just had to leave very quickly. And you couldn't, in this small community, show any sympathy. You'd be ostracized. And there was one white boy that went to school with us. He studied Japanese with us. And the poor fellow had to leave because he felt sympathetic toward us. It's kind of an interesting thing. He's not living anymore, unfortunately. I can remember feeling like I was in a dream world, that all of this wasn't true. I felt like I was in a daze for months, it seemed like. And in a way, we weren't prepared for it, because my folks were prepared for it. They said they would be moved, but they didn't dream for one minute that we would be moved. The children would be moved. And I guess what you call repressing it, because all I remember was it's kind of a nightmare, and that's the kind of a feeling that I had.
In the relocation centers, there were some that didn't cooperate. And there was a group, the so-called renunciants, that renounced their citizenship. But they were American citizens, many of them, but those who had been sent back to Japan when they were young, and they had a lot of the Japanese ideas, and they thought this was a very bad thing to do, and a lot of them rebelled and were very bitter. I think as a group, those people were more bitter about it than we were, that had been born and raised all our lives in this country. There were a lot of hotheads in that group, and in fact, a lot of them took to violence, and there were a lot of, for instance, officers in the JACL that were beaten up and things of that type. When we first went in the centers, there was quite a resentment against the JACL because they thought that we had sold them down the river into the relocation centers. But I think now that they realize that the JACL did the right thing, and they've done a wonderful job since the war.
We were rather naive. We knew we were American citizens, but nobody else knew that, and we weren't, you know, we didn't realize that. And so what happened was that when the war came, that's exactly the situation in which we found ourselves, that certain people who had worked among us, church people and other people whom we had befriended in the course of our growing up and our parents had, knew us, but it was still a rather small minority of people who really knew us and understood us. But as far as the general public is concerned, they had no idea that we were Americans, our loyalty was to this country, and least of all our own government. And I would say generally, I talk about the Japanese problem on the Pacific Coast, California, but it was a localized problem, you see. In 1940, I think we slowly began to realize that what Japan was doing in Manchuria and China did reflect upon us. And I remember in Los Angeles, we set up a speakers bureau. That was 1940. You see, we could see that people identified us with Japan and the people of Japan. So we set up a speakers bureau, going to speak to church groups, women's clubs, service organizations, as many as we could cover, outlining our position that we were Americans, our loyalty was to America, that to us Japan was a foreign country, you see. That was, of course, we realized we were American citizens, and when this talk about evacuating us came up, we didn't take it too seriously at first. We said, well, they couldn't evacuate us. We're American citizens, you see. But it happened. And even today, people ask us, how could that be possible? Because being citizens, you see, we have certain rights. In fact, there was a lot of talk at the time, even when evacuation became quite definite, as to what course we should take, whether we should fight for our rights and stay on the West Coast, or whether we should cooperate with the government and its program of evacuating us from the West Coast. And I would say that the primary consideration in all this thing, as far as we are concerned, is the fact that our parents, not being able to become American citizens, they were aliens ineligible for citizenship. So overnight they became enemy aliens, you see, through no fault of their own. We could hardly say, well, we're going to fight to stay here. We're Americans. We don't care what happens to our parents, you see. And that was, I think, the biggest factor that helped us determine what our course would be. Of course, there again, although we saw it differently, I mean, other people felt that our taking all this was almost an admission of our of some close relationship with the people of Japan. From our standpoint, we felt that maybe this is our peculiar contribution to America's war effort.
You are listening to Japanese in California, a 1959 documentary produced for KPFA by Marshall Windmuller in 1959.